I was upstaged in Nottingham, after reading poetry there, by what lay in the porter's room above.
Les Murray reading his poem Postmortem.
Ginger human skeletons, 8 of them. Disturbed by extensions to the arts centre and reassembled from the dozer's shove, some might have been my ancestors, Nottingham being where my mother's people fled from in the English Civil War. These were older than that migration, crusty little roundheads of sleep, stick bundles half burned to clay by water. Their personhoods had gone into the body of that promise preached to them. What had stayed in their bones were their diseases, the marks of labour in a rope-furrowed shoulder blade, their ages when they died and what they'd eaten. Bread, bacon, beer, cheese, apples, greens. No tomato atoms in them, no potato eens. No coffee yet, or tea, or aspirin. But alcoholic curds, horn-spooned at a fair, an opium physic and peas porridge. The thought that in some cells their programmes might persist, my far parentage, attracted me no more than rebuilding faces for them with wire and moulding. Unsatisfied to go as a detective to the past, I want the past live, with the body we have in the promise. That book which opens when the story ends. Being even a sound modern physique is like owning an apartment in Venice.
Australian poet Les Murray, reading his poem Postmortem. Murray is considered by many literary critics to be the greatest poet in the English language today. Steve Paulson sat down with Les Murray for a very rare interview.
You obviously have a tremendous store of knowledge about literature and poetry in particular, but I read somewhere that you have not wanted to read certain revered poets in the British canon, for instance, John Keats. Is that true?
That was true in school. School's a fair while ago. Now, the reason was that it was completely irrelevant to our life. I mean, there I was, a country kid in a country town high school in the 20th century, being told to read a poetry that came out of the end of the 18th century in England, a totally different world. I mean, leaves fell off trees in that world, for God's sake, in autumn. And it was completely irrelevant to us, and we took no notice of it. And then our English teacher pointed us to certain modern poetry, English poetry of the 1930s, and the sportsmaster, for heaven's sake, turned me on to Australian modern poetry, which I hadn't known existed. And there was some good Australian modern poetry I started reading, and I thought, yeah, this is relevant. This belongs to the country and the age I live in. So I got interested.
Now, you've described yourself in various things that I've read about you as being most at home among the poor white people of Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, you come from a humble background, right?
Poor people, yeah, not humble. The border Scots have never been humble in the history of the world, but they I give you Richard Nixon. But they have been occasionally poor. They've often been poor. You know, Scots are supposed to be mean. It's largely because they're poor.
So you were poor as you were growing up?
Yeah, and my grandfather actually kept my father poor. It was because of a terrible kind of battle between them over who was the better bushman of the two, you know, had the better developed sort of forestry knowledge and timber cutting ability and so on. And then also my parents were terribly unlucky. They had a series of miscarriages, so their life was kind of ruined by these two things. I come from that milieu, you know, it was an unlucky household, really.
How did that background shape your thinking and shape your poetry? I mean, coming out of those circumstances?
It made you distrustful of the world. You thought that the bad was likely to happen, you know, and that things inevitably would go smash. I've never had an onward and upward sort of crazy optimistic view of the world, and I think it probably came out of that upbringing. But it came out of Calvinism as well, you know, the expectation that it's a nice day and we'll pay for it, you know. And I ended up Catholic, but it didn't change that undercurrent of me.
Now, you seem to be a poet who invites a certain amount of biographical scrutiny, and from what I've heard, one of the great...
I don't know why they bother. I mean, they review me sometimes rather than the poems. I figure that's only the poems that ought to be reviewed.
Well, obviously, they're interested in your life as well. And and from what I've heard, one of the great traumas that really did shape your early life was the death of your mother when you were 12.
Yes, poor woman. She died of being too far from hospital and a doctor who couldn't understand the kind of cultural norms of the country. You know, my father was really a 19th century man with tremendous reluctance to talk about women's intimate matter, especially with the worst gossip in the district running the telephone switch. So he was saying things like, she's having a bad turn, she's terrible sick, and the doctor couldn't understand this. He wanted to be told, she's having a miscarriage and she's bleeding to death. So the time she got to hospital, she'd bled so thoroughly that she couldn't be brought back, you know. She hung on for several days, but they couldn't bring her back to being viable. And so Dad collapsed at that point because he blamed himself. He had this terrible grief which was mixed with guilt, and he had it for the next 44 years till he died. And so I kind of lost both parents at once. Dad's addiction was to grief, you know. Huckleberry Finn's father, he had an addiction to crime and booze, but Dad had it to grief. So suddenly I was I had to make it up by myself, you know, be my own parents.
But you wrote about that years later. I mean, obviously that experience stayed with you.
Oh, yeah. And it fed into a depression that I probably inherited from Dad and his father before him. I had depression, but I mean, every poet, nearly every poet has depression. It's common enough. I call it poet's flu. And mine just what differs is the subject matter. Mine was this kind of fear of womanhood and fear of sex because it kills you. You know, you die of miscarriages and things. And other people die of it too. You don't want to cause their death. So, and there I am living in a sort of an age of Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, sex is being advertised with the groceries every day. and having this neurosis riding on me back. So it was a bit of a tension. But I got through the depression pretty well all the way. You always keep some parts of it, but the dog never dies, but the dog gets a lot weaker.
Although I've read that you had a very long bout of depression.
It was long.
In what, for 9 years or something like that?
Yeah, longer than that, really. I thought it had gone, but it hadn't, and it came back. I guess a lot of my bad reputation comes from poems in which I'm fighting it. You know, I'm in the midst of a waking nightmare. But
you were writing during that period, during those really bad years.
I wrote
years.
All the way through. I said to the dog, you know, the black dog, you bastard, you make me cry, I make you sing. And I wrote a long verse novel called Freddie Neptune and a whole lot of poems during it. And then about 8 years into the depression, I came down with a liver abscess and I very nearly died of it and came back in this world. Somewhat to my surprise, and thought, oh, that's good. Now I'll find out how Freddie finishes, you know, because I was only two-thirds of the way through him. So I finished him and published him.
So the best cure to depression is nearly dying?
It helped. It helped, yeah. It's good to have a rehearsal of death because it takes away your fear of it. And you know pretty well how the moves will be.
And one of the pleasures of reading your poems is they come in all varieties. I mean, some are more serious, as we've been talking about. Some are just fun.
Yeah.
And could you read The Kitchen Grammars?
Sure. The Kitchen Grammars. The verb in a Sanskrit or Farsi or Latin or Japanese sentence most frequently comes last. As if the ingredients and spices only after collection, measure, and even preservation might get cooked. To all these cuisines, renown attaches. It's the opening of a Celtic sentence, is a verb, and it was more fire than pot for us very often than ingredients. Had we not fed our severed heads on poetry, final might have been our famous starvation. Upholding cuisine for us are the French, to be counting in scores and called Gallic. In English and many more, in Chinese, the verb surrounds itself, nucleus fashion, with its subjects and qualifiers. Down every slope of the wok they go to the spitting middle, to be sauced, ladled, lidded, steamed, flipped back up, becoming verbs themselves often. And the calm egg centres the meatloaf.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'd offer that as a motto of any college that wants it, actually. The calm egg centres the meatloaf.
Why did you become a poet?
Got interested, fell in love with it. It was just towards the end of school. I mean, that was the 1950s, and all boys were expecting to go to the Third World War, and we were so tough, you know. And then when I saw some modern poetry, first of England and then of Australia, I turned right round. I thought, this is the most concentrated, effective, moving way of writing. I'd already wanted to do art of some sort, and I couldn't paint. I knew nothing about music. But I thought, I want to do this because you can do everything at once in a smaller compass than any other way. You know, I don't have to write novels and plots and all that sort of thing. And the non-living things in the poem are as alive as the living things, and the animals are as alive as the people, and everything's got a kind of equality about it. So it appealed to me intensely, and I've been trying to do it ever since.
So it's the compactness, the conciseness that draws to poetry, more than prose.
Yeah, and the equality of it, the fact that everything in a poem is on level pegging to a degree. It's not a class system in a poem. Or it isn't in one of mine, anyway.
You have dedicated this book to the glory of God, and I know that Catholicism...
Now, there's another loner for you. I mean, it gets blamed for everything.
Now, you have several poems that deal with the religious life and religious ideas.
In this book, only one, really. It's called Church. Would you like me to read that one?
Sure. Well, I was thinking about The Blueprint. That's not about religion? About the afterlife?
It's about the sociology of religion. This one's about real religion.
Okay.
Well, for Joseph Brodsky, who was a friend of mine, he was Jewish and he used to talk about becoming a Presbyterian. And I said, Joseph, I come from there. I warn you, let me tell you about John Calvin, you know. I'll read the poem, Church. The wish to be right has decamped in large numbers, but some come to God in hopes of being wrong. High on the end wall hangs the gospel from before he was books. All judging ends in his fix, all including his own. He rose out of Jewish, not English evolution, and he said the lamp he held aloft to the nations was Jewish. Freedom still eats freedom, justice eats justice, love, even love. One retarded man said, Church makes me want to be naughty. But naked in a muddy trench with many thousands, someone saying, the true God gives his flesh and blood. Idols demand yours off you.
Is it hard to turn your faith into poetry, to write about it?
Tis hard, yeah. That was a thing that I've written about a good many times, about human sacrifice. I mean, any big system, or sometimes even quite small systems of thought, ideology, fashion, etc., is liable to demand human sacrifice, whether we dismiss some kind of people or that we conquer somebody or something like that, you know. I abhor anything that demands human sacrifice. I figure I could only trust a God who said, look, I'll be the human sacrifice, you know. You don't have to be. I'll give that sacrifice to you.
Well, I want to follow up then with what you call a poem about the sociology of religion, The Blueprint. Can you read that?
Okay. The Blueprint. Whatever the great religions offer, it is afterlife their people want. Heaven, paradise, higher reincarnations, together or apart. For these they will love God or butter karma. Afterlife. Wherever it already exists, people will crawl into ship's framework or suffocate in truck containers to reach it. They will conjure it down on their beaches and their pooled clay streets, inject it, marry into it. The secular withholds any obeisance that is aimed upwards. It must go declaratively down. But an accident of consciousness between two eternities of oblivion? All of us have done one of those eternities already on our ear. After the second, we require an afterlife greater and stranger than science gives us now. Life like, then unlike what mortal life has been. Blueprint 2 goes like this. Life after death, with all the difficult people away in a separate felicity.
That's a wonderful little addendum.
That's me and my father-in-law. We'd never occupy the same heaven, would we?
Les Murray's latest book of poetry is called The Biplane Houses. Steve Paulson spoke with him.